21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. You're listening to what I consider the greatest of all the rock groups, the Traveling Wilburys. And this is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD, hanging out in this part of the universe. And sometimes we can identify it, and other times we think it's somewhere else. And, of course, our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner. And our engineer is A.Y. Warshaw. Our guest is Dr. Sue Carter, a pioneer in the role of the hormones oxytocin and vasopressin in social bonding, parental behavior, stress, and reproduction. You can learn more about her and her link and link to her. Well, let me say that again. About her and link to some of her many research papers on the front page at 21stcenturyradio.com and more information at her husband's website, Stephen Porges. .com. I'll have to spell it. Did I get that wrong again, Sue?
Oh, close enough.
Oh, I'm getting close.
P-O-R-G-E-S.
I'm about 75% there.
Yeah.
But I'll spell it again because you need to go to this website as well. STEPHENPORGES.com. Now, Sue, effects of... let me skip that one. Why is there reason to be concerned about the use of labor-inducing drugs like Pitocin, or is that how it's pronounced?
Pitocin. It's called Pitocin.
Pitocin.
Yeah.
Whoa. Which is a synthetic form of oxytocin. Pitocin.
Right. Why am I worried about it, you mean?
Yeah. Why is there concern?
Because we don't know anything about the consequences for either the baby or the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And as we discussed in the last hour, I was given this drug, hormone, whatever we want to call it. It's a synthetic form of oxytocin, and that was over 31 years ago. Realized quickly that there wasn't anything known about it, and have, over the last three decades, then put a lot of my own personal energy into trying to understand it. Now, just within the last year, in fact, today I saw an article, the first one I had seen, tell you about in a second, that was pretty scary. And this was animal research actually done at Cambridge, University of Cambridge in England, in which they looked at the effects of either being induced to be born or being born through more natural processes. The induced labor then altered the basic metabolism of the baby. In this case, it was a horse, a foal. The animals had a whole different, how to explain this simply, their use of glucose was different permanently. Okay, this is pretty scary stuff because, in case you haven't noticed, we are involved in an epidemic of obesity in the United States.
I've noticed that, yes.
I've noticed. And we don't understand why. I mean, I have been kind of, again, I've been so obsessed with oxytocin, I try not to get to wander too far off of track. But I think that something fundamental has happened, and I don't understand it. I don't know if it's sugar in our diet or, you know, lack of something that we're missing. But this one study, and it's a very small study done, as I said, in horses, was the first one I had seen in which they really looked carefully at the offspring, and in this case at the role of the pancreas, to see if it was normal and or similar in the animals that were born versus those that were induced to be born. So both were born, but in one case it was an induction with Pitocin to speed up the labor. And this, by the way, is done in animals all the time, as it is in humans. This is not something that only humans experience. Well, those baby horses had a different physiology. And this has been something I suspected might be going on, and of course this doesn't prove anything about humans. It's only an animal study, but it's sort of a first clue. It just came out within the last week or two that something very fundamental might be changed by the birth process.
Oh.
And that the way I've looked at it, I've been interested in this idea for a long time, but there wasn't much data. My thinking was that the body used oxytocin as a kind of signal to decide what kind of world we were entering. So if it's a very safe time, you've got a lot of oxytocin, you might go into one sort of mold or morph, and your body would change in its way of handling stress, in its way of doing things. And so I'm concerned that this signal, oxytocin's a part of a signaling system. It's not just a birth hormone or a lactation hormone or a love hormone. It's there to give information to every cell in the body. And among those cells that it seems to be programming are the ones that run the pancreas and the ability of the body to produce, and then also in the case of the horse study, to use sugar was changed. So this, to me, is like mind-blowing, okay? Mm-hmm. Here we are, we're in the midst of doing something, and we don't know that one piece of this story is altering another. Again, we talked last hour about how things are interactive, and you can't just study one piece. Well, this is a very good example. You can't just study the reproductive system, because we have embedded in our need for reproduction is our need to produce energy to feed ourselves and to feed our babies, mm-hmm. especially a problem in mammals. So we've got a complicated sort of system all designed here, very intricate, with all the little pieces working great, and then we go in with a sledgehammer and change that system, we have to then recognize that we may be getting consequences we weren't looking for.
Yes, of course. Well, you know, I've noticed websites that are selling oxytocin spray as an over-the-counter treatment for stress reduction and likability boosting. Now, there's something. It's nothing like having a likability boosted.
And
yes. I'm sorry.
That's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Because I've just told you that this is a very delicate system, and I think the last thing that we should be doing is altering it without any knowledge whatsoever of what the consequences are.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you give too much oxytocin to a woman in labor, the receptors that normally respond to oxytocin sort of go hide inside of the membranes. They are no longer available. Scientists call this downregulation. And sure enough, you need more oxytocin to get the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can extrapolate this to the idea of going off and buying a spray of oxytocin and using it on yourself or especially on a child. I think it's a dangerous idea myself.
Yes, sir.
But there are, don't misunderstand me, I don't think a few sprays of oxytocin are going to hurt people, and it's not addictive, like it's not cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't give you a high. Mm-hmm. But using it as a way, any time you use a medicine to supplement a natural function, the natural function usually sort of slows down and takes a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want the oxytocin system not to be working properly. It's just too important to all of these things that are going on in our lives. Like you said, stress reduction. I mean, the website is fundamentally correct when it says that oxytocin is involved in all these things that they list. The part that's not correct is the idea that you can take some and improve mm-hmm. on your body's function. Mm-hmm. That's just foolish.
So it could be dangerous.
Over time, it could be dangerous. Yes.
No.
And in developing organisms, I think it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's going to hurt adults in a sort of short-term use. In fact, the problem here is that humans are just not very bright, and sometimes we think, oh, if a little bit's good, more is better.
Yeah, instead of taking two aspirins, take 12, and you really
exactly.
knock it out there.
Exactly. Well, that's a great example. So you get a bleeding ulcer, and, mm-hmm. and you don't feel the headache anymore, right?
No, you don't. You're feeling just fine for a while.
Yeah. But those websites, I think, are frightening. I don't know how many people are buying that stuff. I don't know if anyone, no one's admitted to me using it. But I do know that at the University of Illinois, we have children coming into clinics in our autism centers, and parents there are admitting that they've been trying to self-medicate their kids with autism.
Oh, my.
And there, I can tell you there's a study going on at the University of North Carolina where they're actually systematically studying the use of oxytocin in children with autism, and they're seeing side effects that are not, that are completely opposite to those that they were looking for. So they're getting more repetitive behaviors, not in everybody, but in a subset. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this isn't permanent. They're not, like, damaging these kids by this research, but what they are doing is giving us a different point of view that we really, unfortunately, we really need to understand it, because there may be times when oxytocin can be used medically in a responsible way that actually are very beneficial. But the problem is how much, how long, is it being used the way the body normally produces it, or is the person taking it in a way that's sort of overriding the natural function? Well, we just don't know. Yeah. Don't know hardly anything.
We just don't know enough, that's for sure.
But it's not a controlled substance, oxytocin's not. So it's not illegal to sell it. It's just, in my opinion, unethical.
Well, before we switch our attention to fatherhood, let's talk for a while about the general health benefits of social bonding. And we sure could use some social bonding these days. From an anthropological and evolutionary point of view, why did the oxytocin system evolve in humans?
Well, it really evolved in mammals and a parallel system in birds. When in those kinds of organisms, it's very important to have two parents. It's very important to take care of your offspring. So you're not just leaving little baby fish in the water or an egg someplace. We're making an investment in the offspring. And in mammals, it gets rather extreme because we're raising that egg inside of our body to the point that it's pretty big, like a human baby. And then we need, not only are we investing before it's born, but we also needed a system that would guarantee that there would be a parent there, at least a mother, and ideally other parents or other caretakers, fathers, aunts, uncles, everybody, so that that growing and rather needy individual would have a lot of care, a lot of food, warmth, and so forth. So the purpose of social bonds and the purpose of the hormones that support social bonds, like oxytocin, becomes quite obvious. We really can't, no human baby at birth can take care of itself. No mammal baby, for the most part, can take care of itself. Almost all of them have some needs for food and sustenance and, say, warmth from the parent. So these social bonds are just a mechanism to guarantee that we have sufficient parenting in order to develop up to the point that we are then independent.
So for survivability, it would be enormously important.
Right.
And when we take a look at our, let's just say the American culture today and how many children are born without not just two parents, but sometimes their parents aren't around at all, you can almost predict that there would be an increase in serious problems within that culture that would emerge over a period of maybe decades or a little longer, or even shorter.
Yeah, I think shorter. I think that some form of caretaking, it doesn't have to be a biological parent to work, and that's where the fact that we do have artificial foods is handy. Historically, if your mother couldn't feed you, you were fed by another woman, mm-hmm. or you died. Mm-hmm. So wet nurses were very important as a backup. But you're right, the most invested individual is usually the mother and the father, and other relatives. It doesn't have, they don't have to be biological relatives. This biologic, this system, this ability to form a bond is so powerful, it doesn't recognize whether you're related or not. It doesn't even care. It just cares that there's a way, a guaranteed, a kind of insurance policy that has to be there. It's more than insurance. It's essential. That has to be there to guarantee that there will be a caretaker. And, of course, the human version of this is extreme because our babies are so immature and they have these large developing nervous systems that have to be supported for not just by food, but in all other kinds of ways for periods of years. So if there isn't an adequate caretaker, indeed the outcome's not very optimistic.
So giving and receiving of love are essential components of human existence then.
And especially to allow us to have our, to use our sort of very large and complicated brains. To be able to have complex cognition, we have to get out of that survival mode. This is actually where my husband's research is very important. We have to get out of the mode of just staying alive and be safe in order to think, in order to learn, to be educated, to have culture. We have to get past the survival mode. I mean, if you want to look at the planet, you can see wherever there's a war or conflict, and people are frightened, don't feel safe, you don't see much culture developing during that time in those places.
Very true.
We lose that ability. We're just trying to survive, stay alive.
Yeah. Well, the many purposes of oxytocin demonstrate how economical nature is. How can one well-designed chemical be employed to meet so many different demands of the body?
Well, you said it. It's the sort of whole set of building blocks for life are used over and over again. So oxytocin is just 9 amino acids. It's very simple. It's not even a big protein like insulin. But once the body made that molecule, or once an organism, it didn't have to be. Remember, we're talking something that predates even vertebrates. It goes back to insects, to other species. So once that molecule was available, then the body or organisms find uses for them over and over for the same molecule. So almost all of the good stuff is used over and over again. Oxytocin is an example. It just happens to be especially prominent and to us humans kind of interesting because we're interested in these things that it does to us. It sort of takes over in some ways some of our emotional systems, and they're so primitive that we can't even cognitively think about them. So we can't really understand love because it's such a primitive set of emotional behaviors. It doesn't fit into our rational world.
Do you know that within certain, well, I guess in the old days they would call them secret societies such as Rosicrucians or whatever, that their definition of love is the cohesive force of the universe.
Well, I think that's reasonable. I can understand that, and I agree. And what I would use when I was started doing this work, I would have said social bonds or attachments rather than using the word love. But and of course, I don't need to tell you because love has been borrowed and as a word reused for many, many different things, different meanings.
Sure. Yeah.
So we have compassionate love, passionate love, we have love of country and so forth. But the biology, the part of this that's sort of amazing is that the biological basis of all of these constructs are probably very similar, and they get back to these similar old brain systems and old molecules.
Well, our radio station has a compassionate love for continuing to survive. And so we take our a break right now with our guest, Sue Carter, Dr. Sue Carter, a pioneer in the role of hormones, oxytocin. Please go to 21stcenturyradio.com. you know, the more we talk, the more sometimes I find myself leaving my body, because this is so fascinating. It's something that I'm so glad that I bumped into within the last year or so. We'll be back with Dr. Sue Carter in just a few minutes.
My name is Sally Rush Wagner, and you are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. This man knows how to interview. Stay tuned and be sure and listen to this show. And if you want to visit me, I am the director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation. Check out our website at matildajocelyngage.org.
Now, it's true that my wife knows that I've fallen in love with Dr. Matilda Gage. She's 175 years old, I think, about now. But you have to understand that this was one of the most courageous women I've ever read about or ever studied. And I just wanted to tell you that. So our guest for the rest of the hour, of course, is Dr. Sue Carter, a pioneer in the role of hormones, oxytocin, vasopressin. Did I get that right? Yes, I did, I think so, in social bonding. And her husband's website is also important. Please go to it at Stephen Porges, and that is stephenporges.com. I'm going to spell it because it's not how you think, generally. STEPHENPORGES.com. Oh, Susan... Or Sue, tell us about the importance of early social experiences, that is, attention versus neglect, in the physical and psychological health of humans.
Well, thanks for asking, Bob, because this, in my opinion, is one of the really big questions that are sort of on the planet at the moment. How is it, and what is the right way to raise a child? And attending to a baby, whether it be a prairie bull or a human, is absolutely critical. They can't just be fed. And they need some kind of dynamic interaction. And part of the secret to this is because the mammalian nervous system is not, in general, able to operate without other. It has to have others to make it complete. So we're all part of each other. People talk this way all the time in sort of esoteric terms. But I'm talking in very concrete terms, that if you want to punish an adult even, all you do is you put them off in isolation or solitary confinement, probably worse, considered to be worse punishments than death. Well, now imagine a baby, and that baby's nervous system has to be tuned and programmed for later life by its interactions with its caretakers. Remember, I'm telling you, it doesn't have to be a mother. It can be a surrogate mother, can be a father, can be another relative, or it can just be an adoptive parent. Doesn't matter. What matters is that that individual begins to interact with the baby, engage with the baby, and help that baby regulate its emotional state. So what happens during neglect or deprivation, the nervous system sort of goes out of whack. I don't know any scientific terms for this. In other words, it just doesn't work right. And it's possible the animal literature and the human literature is starting to, it looks like it's even worse. To be deprived or neglected is even worse than to be abused. Mm-hmm. So somehow children can adapt to being abused, but they can't adapt to being completely neglected. Isolated. They can't learn language, they can't learn emotion regulation, and they just don't function well.
Are males especially vulnerable to the effects of negative early experiences?
I don't think we know for sure, which I think that they're different. Certainly in our research, we found that manipulations like exposure to hormones seem to affect the males more than females during early life. So part of the answer is probably yes, but doesn't mean that females don't need these regulatory and sort of emotional and endocrine regulators as well. It's just it's operated a little differently. And as you may know, the male reproductive system and testosterone is already being secreted right at the time before birth, at the time of birth, and there's actually a spike in testosterone in males around the first 3 months of life. So that system's being tuned, that hormonal system from the testes is being tuned in early life, and it may be vulnerable during that time to all kinds of disruptions that then sort of cascade into other processes that, again, haven't been properly studied yet.
Well, is there anything an adult can do to counteract the negative effects of early experiences if they grew up neglected or abused?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. What can you do? Well, the first thing is to seek safe harbor, to find people to interact with, if possible, that will help you develop the emotion regulation that's really necessary for normal mental health. So, and the tendency is not to do that, I think. I think people who've been neglected, some of them, not all, some one version of the adaptive strategy is to just kind of keep on isolating yourself. Another one that's even got a scientific name, borderline personality disorder, that seems to play out. Children who've had a lot of neglect in early life seem to need other, go looking for other, but they start to want to control the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, doesn't work too well either. You've got this social behaviors, a dynamic and reciprocal thing. You can't just sort of swallow up another person and hope that that person can take care of you. So we have this always a kind of a interesting but difficult balance between doing things just right.
Well, one of the most positive tracks of research is what researchers are learning about the oxytocin system and certain forms of autism. Please tell us about this connection.
Okay, well, the idea that, first, that autism might be affected by oxytocin came very early because one of the first interesting things we knew about oxytocin was that it regulated social behavior, and autism is defined by deficits in social behavior. So actually there are many, some people talk about the autisms rather than just one disorder, but all of them by definition have some kind of deficits in social dynamic social interactions, a lack of reciprocity, a lack of eye contact, a lack of ability to interact with others. So it was kind of a natural connection. But if you look in the literature now, your readers can look on something called PubMed, a free website. You can see abstracts. And if you look up the words oxytocin and autism, you'll find hundreds of papers. Most of them have come out within the last 10 years.
In
fact, most of them have come out in the last 2 years. And what they are mostly are studies in humans that show some kind of relationship between the genetics of the oxytocin receptor and behavior. And those are at the moment not real clear, but there's something important going on. And then the other studies are going to be from animal models. And what you find is that animals that have had, in some way, have deficits in oxytocin, either because of genetic manipulation, something like that, those animals tend to have autistic-like social behaviors. They lack this dynamic reciprocal interaction that's normal behavior. So they may not be asocial. They may actually want to be around others, but they don't know how to do it. And I think some people believe some forms of autism have that kind of dynamic to them. So it's not that in all people who've been called autistic are asocial. It's that their social behavior isn't regulated enough to allow it to sort of be allow others in and have dynamic interactions. But as I mentioned, what I don't think we can say at the moment is that oxytocin is a cure for autism. And we don't even know, for example, if you measure oxytocin levels in autism, in many individuals it's quite high, higher than normal. So the problem may not be the hormone itself, the problem may be deficits in the substrates, the nervous system and the receptors for oxytocin and other systems that are not in some way sort of working properly. And this is actually why, one of the reasons I had given you steveporges.com to look at is because there's a lot of information in my husband's work that is very important to understanding not autism as a disorder, but some of the symptoms that come out of autism and how these might be helped by sort of just the knowledge that these are neural processes and that they're processes that can change. They can change on the spot if the individual feels safe. Mm-hmm. So there's one biological construct that keeps coming up in both the oxytocin literature and the autism literature, and that is the concept of safety. And all of the questions, actually every question you've asked me, I think if you wanted to distill it down to its simplest essence, it's that if we are to be healthy and we are to grow, we need to feel safe. Mm-hmm. So we need parents, we need the safety of social bonds, we need the safety of a healthy nervous system, a family, whatever. And those relationships, the friends, they don't have, again, the genetic pieces of who we interact with are not as important as the fact that these bonds are there and that they protect us. And so autistic children are just like everybody else. They have a need for safety. And in some cases, there may be some sorts of disorder or damage. We don't really understand autism at all. But whatever it is, it's possible that if you can help a child feel safe, you can get, or an adult, you can see improvements in symptoms immediately. And that's what a lot of clinicians are finding. That's very, very important, perhaps more important for an autistic individual than a non-autistic one, to feel safe. And you don't need drugs for this. You don't need clinicians. You just need an awareness that that nervous system needs to be in a safe place and to feel, to give everything you can to support this sense of safety.
Well, we found a safe place right now to do our final break. And when we return, we talk again. I think we're going to approach oxytocin's a possible improvement of one's ability to read the mind of another from facial cues with Dr. Sue Carter. And we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Janie Hendricks, sister of Jimi Hendricks, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh, it's Aunt Jane. Aunt Jane just stopped by here, friends. Our guest is Dr. Sue Carter, a pioneer in the role of the hormones oxytocin, vasopressin in social bonding, parental behavior, stress, and reproduction. You can learn more about her and link to some of her many research papers on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or go to her husband's website, Stephen Porges, at StephenPorges.com. No, that's not. What are you going to say? My boss is yelling at me right now. Well, I need to be yelled at from time to time. And I'll spell it one more time. This is the last time. StephenPorges.com. Okay, you know, friends, once again, we need another hour. We're not going to have another hour, so there's a lot of questions I won't be able to ask, but we will touch on how does oxytocin improve one's ability to read the mind of another from facial cues?
Okay, if you'd like to discuss this, you have to recognize that I'm not an expert. This is a whole field of science, the sort of cognitive, social cognition has become a field of science. And what people do in this field is they'll actually show pictures or sometimes videos, usually just pictures of a human emotion, sometimes with nothing but the eyes showing. And what was discovered early on was that a little bit of oxytocin, at least in men, could actually make or seems to improve the ability of men to recognize the type of emotion that they're seeing. Now, the studies in women have not been done as systematically, and so we don't know as much. Interestingly, almost all the research where oxytocin's given has been done in men because they were afraid that it might cause a spontaneous abortion or have some reproductive effect in women. Anyway, the answer, the short of this, sort of short version of this is that even a tiny amount of oxytocin briefly ingested by putting it, making it a nasal spray, seem to have some benefits. But one more time, I'm going to say I want to make this really, really clear. Oxytocin is not a panacea. It is not something that you can use. Those websites that say so are simply wrong, and they're wrong-headed because they're, even though there might be a temporary apparent benefit of using a little oxytocin over time, which is what we really worry about with social behavior. We're not talking about minutes of social behavior. We're talking about a whole lifetime. Giving something that interferes with this system or can substitute for this system is just not, I don't think, a good idea. I think what we have to do instead is understand how the body releases the hormones, how it uses them. We really do need research. I know that's kind of a boring thing to say, but we need to understand how it works so we can get our own bodies to work properly. And in the meantime, even if you don't know, and the reason I've asked people to go to StephenPorges.com is that there's a lot of good information in there written by my husband on this topic of how to make the body feel safe. And when the body feels safe, it'll make its own oxytocin. Most of us do not have a shortage. It's not a deficit. It's that our body doesn't have the ability to use the hormone because it just doesn't feel safe, and it's not safe to be social. If it's not safe to be social, then we're not social. We get into a fear mode, and everything changes.
You also note that studies by your husband, Stephen Porges, have indicated that the desire to engage in positive behaviors and express goodness may have archaic roots, even under conditions where there are no obvious benefits to being good. Boy, this sounds like Socrates to me. I wish we had time to go into that, but I need there are some other questions that I'm desperately trying to find answers to, and one of them is, according to some researchers who are extrapolating gender differences from oxytocin levels, it appears that women have more of the personality traits to be better focused problem solvers in comparison to their male counterparts. Can you add anything to the discussions that imply women are being possibly better suited for political and diplomatic roles?
Well, not really, because it's not my expertise. I can give you my personal opinion, and it is based on biology, and that is that men and women have different strategies for surviving. They have different roles historically. In our modern culture, a lot of things that are done by both sexes, but historically, and the one thing that I think women generally don't get as deeply involved with are defense and warlike behavior. So if you're asking me, should we have a calmer head or a less assertive head involved or thought process involved in our decisions about whether we should engage in war, I would say yes. Wouldn't have to be women. It could be anybody. But it should be people who are not, who are using the cognitive processes that you're talking about, not just dealing with emotional states. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to give the impression here that I think that men can't make decisions. I think our whole culture is based on male decisions. But women have a different point of view, and they bring a kind of, I don't have good language for this, but a kind of sanity to social behavior if they're healthy women. Not every woman's healthy mentally, not every man's healthy, but the more sort of that we feel safe, the better our mental health is, the better our decisions are. So I'm hoping those decisions that affect us all are being made by people who are in states of sort of rational thought, not emotional states.
Well, I'd like to also hear you comment on the rise of the fundamentalist and religious right and their continued efforts to repeal the reproductive rights of women. What does this say about our social evolution and becoming more compassionate as a species?
Well, I think we don't have to use evolution here. I think we can just look at the states of individuals at the moment. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest in the Bible Belt, and I saw how certain kinds of religions, a lot of different kinds, worked with fear as an emotional state to engage people and to get them to donate, you know, when the passing the plate, it used to be called, was happening. It would happen just after some terrifying imagery, often brought by a Baptist minister when I was a kid, of fire and brimstone. That kind of way of motivating people, fear-based motivation, whether it be about religion or politics or whatever, it almost never comes up with a good result, mm-hmm. because it's a short-term strategy for getting things to happen right away and for motivating people to either vote in a certain way or be afraid of other groups so that you'll take care of your own group, that sort of in-group, out-group thinking. Mm-hmm. All of that is fear-based, and it's very effective because fear is very, very powerful. We have to stay alive. But if we can stand back a little bit from whatever's happening in our lives and say, well, is this the right thing to do, or is this just the momentary solution that may seem like a good idea? It may, for example, seem like a good idea to bomb some other country, but it's almost never a very good idea because the short-term solution then leads to years and years of warfare. So we have to use our knowledge of our nervous systems. We have to appreciate our own fear. We can't be in denial of it. And we have to use that knowledge then to help us figure out what is really the right thing to do. And you don't need words like religion here or politics. You just need to think rationally and say, well, is it a good idea for the planet to destroy itself? Well, no, it's not a very good idea, right? Your website's fine. But is it a good idea for us to put pollution into the Chesapeake Bay? No, not a very good idea. But it was easier to do that than to take the long-term solutions to these problems. So I think a lot of the things that I'm calling rational are really looking at life across a longer stretch of time than just the moment. Mm-hmm. But people who use this as a way of manipulating the behavior of others will usually focus right on the moment, and they want an immediate solution. And I'd say most of those are not good solutions.
Well, if estrogen is the factor that makes women better at processing oxytocin's caring and bonding tendencies, how is the oxytocin system affected by menopause?
Okay, well, another of those good questions that hasn't been studied very much. There are one or two studies where they measured oxytocin in blood, which is not where we're interested. We'd like to know what's in the brain. And they did find, in some cases, slightly lower levels in postmenopausal women, but not big differences, not the kind of differences that would be able to explain behavior. So I'm not sure that estrogen is really the answer. I think that oxytocin's more entwined with these survival systems than it is with reproduction. And I think that oxytocin's role, estrogen does have a role in the regulation of oxytocin, and it can be seen under certain conditions and not others. And nobody's really figured this one out yet. You saved all the hard questions for last, didn't you?
Of course.
So the answer is, I'm probably not going to give you a simple answer there, except to say that it's not simple. Okay, postmenopausal women still have a lot of oxytocin. They're not in some horrible deprivation state. And they're able to regulate their emotions, and they do remarkably well, okay? Mm-hmm. And menopause is not something to be feared. It's a part of a natural process. It is the case that this is a place where medicine may be able to help a little bit, but we don't know the relationship between estrogen and oxytocin, and both of them have big, big biological jobs to be done. So it's time to study them more. I wish you could, you know, I hope if we're broadcasting to Washington that some of the people who determine policy about research will take these ideas into account and start to demand that research be done on things that are so important to our health and survival. And estrogen and oxytocin are two of the big questions, and they get very, very little research support.
Well, we do have, our show is more popular, actually, outside of the state of Maryland and across the planet, thanks to the Internet, where our major listeners really are literally around the world. And, of course, Washington, D.C. is so very close, and our good friend is Barbara Mikulski, our governor, O'Malley, et cetera, who I'm certain are not necessarily listening at this moment, but they hear about this show frequently because we bother them a lot. In a sense, we bother them. In a sense, we communicate with them about certain things. This has really been quite a joy for me. I love to learn things, and I have learned so much from your research. There's so many words that you use, though, that in all of this literature, McDonald's papers and everybody else's papers, that I had to always go to a dictionary to learn what they are.
It's been my pleasure, and I do hope, you know, I hope your listeners, I wasn't too technical, because I really do want to communicate these ideas. I'm not selling oxytocin. I'm really selling constructs like safety and being nice to each other.
What about your husband's book that he's working on right now, or has he just completed?
He has a book that came out in April. Are we on the air?
Yes.
Hi, everybody. Well, he has a book that came out in April 2011, and it's already in its fourth printing.
Already.
It's called The Polyvagal Theory. And what it does is try to explain some of the neurobiology that underlies safety and emotion regulation. These same things that oxytocin, say, works upon, but which we didn't know when we started working together.
Well, maybe sometime in the future he'll be able to join us. Thank you very much, Dr. Sue Carter. And I learned so much. Well, we'll be back next week on 21st Century Radio.
And breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Sal Giangrasso. The Northeast getting hit with severe weather.